notes, so there's nothing really flashy, just text.
Yeah, we're ready.
You cool? Okay. This talk kind of germinated back when Scott emailed me and asked me about doing a quantum computing talk, which we did yesterday morning. I emailed him back and said, yeah, sure, I'll be glad to, because I was thinking, you know, free badge. Then I emailed him back and said, you know, I just picked up this book. It's really neat. I'm starting to read it a little bit more. It's not something I normally get into because I'm really ADD when it comes to philosophies and things of that. I mean, general philosophies. I really admire people who can draw up philosophies of all these different people and apply them to a problem. But unfortunately, I am not a philosopher. I-A-N-A-P. The book that I was reading, it's called The Hacker Ethic. The guy's name, and I did not make this up, Pekka Heiminen. I'll say Heiminen. I'm not really sure how to pronounce it. There is here's a little table of contents. The prologue was written by Linus. Does everybody know what I mean by the name Linus? Generally? Anybody not? Okay, I assume you do. Yeah, it's a Peanuts character. And the three middle parts are written by Pekka himself. The ethics hackers tend to work under, and hacker I will define for you, in terms of their work ethic, their money ethic, and their social network ethic, which he calls a nethic. The epilogue is written by a man named Manuel Castles, who has written a tome, actually a three-volume tome, on the network interactions of people in the new economies, the information economy that we're in right now, and stuff that I could even begin to start talking about. Heiminen's book is centered around basically technology computer type hackers, but the term, and he makes the call that the term is applicable to everything else. Obviously, see, for instance, Hacking 101, 201, 301. Definition time, hacker. This is, I just did a little dict call to dict.org, had their jargon file there, looked up the word hacker. 1 through 5 here are pretty familiar to most technology-minded computer people. And you may not be able to read this. I'll read a couple of them. Person who enjoys exploring. Come on. Oh, there you go. Person who enjoys exploring the details of programmable systems and how to stretch their capabilities. One who programs obsessively, enthusiastically is a key word there. And who enjoys the programming rather than just thinking about it. Hello, computer science majors. A person capable of appreciating hack value. When we get down here to number 6, we start to get into the definitions that I appreciate. An expert or enthusiast of any kind, those that apply passion to what they're doing. One who enjoys creatively overcoming and circumventing limitations, no matter what the system, no matter what the field. This, number 8 here, is a deprecated term, and you've heard the argument, and I'm not going to go into it again. Basically, my opinion is this. We had the word first. Let the media get their own word. If you do the same lookup on hacker ethic, you'll find basically this first part is what I'm interested in, the first definition. What corresponds here to Pekka's nethic, the belief that information sharing is a powerful and positive good. There's an ethical duty of hackers to share their expertise by writing open source code and facilitating access to information. There's plenty, the whole nethic part of it is full of controversy. It's full of different opinions. Take it what you will. This talk's not about that. every other talk in this room is more or less about the social interaction of hackers and people interested in copyrights, intellectual property, blah, blah, blah. This one's not. This one's about the personal journeys of being a hacker. Like I said, Linus wrote the prologue. He came up with something called Linus's Law. Law's in quotes here because it's not. It's just an observation or an opinion. I hate it. That's a personal pet peeve of mine. Categories of motivation. That which motivates you to do anything in this world. He was trying to classify everything that drives you. First level, survival. That which keeps us alive. Food, shelter, on a societal level, procreation, air, when James isn't taking it up. on a second level, social interaction, social life and your status within your social, within your peers. That which furthers your relationship with peers. And the third level of it was were described as entertainment. The things that make things fun, make you happy, satisfy us on a personal level, get your mind out of the gutter. Linus's Law, these things are not really associated, or he's not really concerned that much with that these motivations exist, but tracking activities that we go through as they progress through this level. And you know, sex probably went to entertainment pretty damn quickly, actually, as we were evolving. Food and eating, you know, at its basic level, keeps us alive. Basis for social interactions often, and certainly entertainment. War, thanks to CNN, has now reached the entertainment stage. And although, you know, it's probably not the first war that provided entertainment for somebody, I'm sure the Gulf War was one of the most widely publicized. Computer here embraces computer hackers' progressions in these motivations. How Linus sees people that are interested in computers go through the motivation cycle. Survival. If you already have a computer on your desk, you probably already have enough money for food and shelter. Nevertheless, that is often a basic mode when you're thinking about, I've got to get a job, I've got to pay my rent, I've got to be able to buy food. So there's definitely a motivation in there for getting a job or for doing work in the computer industry or on your own. Social interaction, email, chatting, news groups. There's that it also applies to the free flow of information about technologies, about various also applies to the peer recognition factor in of a hacker, which I'm about to talk about in a minute. Entertainment. We're not just talking about games. The final level of motivation, where a computer to a hacker almost is entertainment in itself. If he's really passionately interested in how it works, passionately interested in using it, the computer itself is the activity. That's something that you would spend all day at a job staring at a screen, bored off of your mind at. You might spend 50, 60, 70 hours a week if you did not have to do that necessarily. And end up in utter fascination. Tech support is one of these. I mean, how many people have worked a tech support job and know how crappy that job is? And then how many of you go home and screw with your computers all night long? Right. I mean, you're doing it for yourself. Probably primary cause there. But, I mean, that's just an indication of it, that these things, to us, for computer hackers, just playing with the computer is in itself the pinnacle of motivation. It's that entertainment. I call this a movement. It's not really because, you know, organizing hackers, I'm sure that everybody knows, is likened to herding cats. you can never organize a group of hackers to do anything. You pretty much have to do it all yourself, and hope and expect people to chip in, didn't do various parts. That's how a lot of these various conventions get held. Many people in the room, like I put down here, you probably already do work that's interesting to you and is meaningful to you, but you're not normal because you're at DragonCon. No, that's kind of rude, but it's probably true. You're probably all intelligent people that have found ways to enjoy what you're doing for what allows you to live. But, or you're working on it, right? You understand that the concept is there that you can perhaps enjoy yourself and be able to live. This movement, this general trend, is generally growing in the IT profession fastest because people get into it. It's a lot easier to start up, get interested in it, get interested in playing around with computers or whatnot, and then be able to find a job doing something in computers. You probably, if you have a job doing something in computers, not necessarily all that enthusiastic, but you probably come home and play with a computer after that, unless you're, not really that, unless you don't have that hacker mentality towards it, you probably go and do all sorts of things on your computer at home that you couldn't do at work. Packard describes this as this movement, this general feeling, as he labels it as a hacker work ethic, and tell you why in a second, because he contrasts it to an already existent work ethic, the Protestant work ethic. Protestant work ethic, I'm sorry, let me go into this a second, except this new work ethic really isn't all that new. In fact, it's older than Protestant work ethic. It's older than Protestants, it's older than Catholics. Basically, from the time of Plato, people have been, the academics have been enthused about what they do. That's why they do it. Every time you go over to a university and you don't find a professor that's jaded from the concept of begging for money every year, the graduate students you find, they are generally the ones who have the passion for what they're doing, who are there day after day, night after night, 10, 12 hours a day or more, doing what they love to do. And they're getting paid shit for it, but they're there. They're going to get a nice degree. Maybe that is their ultimate desire, is to get the degree so they can get a good paying job. But most of the people I've seen on college campuses, generally, they do have a passion for their work. There's something different about them than when I had normal jobs and the people that I saw there. This quote, hacker ethic, is a challenge to business, because money, while it may be a goal, it isn't necessarily the ultimate goal. And from the people that, we're talking about the people that actually do the work, not the managers. The people that actually do the work generally have this kind of attitude. The manager will have an attitude that the only goal of this business is to make money. Well, okay. Well, there's probably a rift in there somewhere. If you have someone who cares maybe a little bit more about being interested in his work and can take a smaller salary to be more interested, you might have a misunderstanding between the managers and the workers. Information professionals may be leading the movement, but it isn't necessarily limited to them. Anybody who rethinks the importance of work and money versus overall fulfillment in their work, they've probably implemented some ways of implementing this hacker work ethic into their work. I know I recently went back to school because I got a little bit of money to go back to school, but before that I had a regular job. I worked on a satellite program, coding, and you'd think, wow, you hack a coding. No, when we're talking NASA contract, paperwork out the wazoo, generally following very stupid guidelines on legacy code that just drove me the hell nuts. I looked at some of this stuff and I said, well, okay, I can be driven nuts, or I can look at it and propose things to my boss and say, you know, I see that we do this same thing five different ways in five different pieces of the code. Why don't we unify? Why don't we put it in a library, do something a little bit different? Go through and change the comments. I couldn't make them funny because the customer had the source code after we had done with it, but it was just ways that I could make things a little bit more interesting and be able to deal with the job as it was. Before we talk a little bit more about what the motivations and the characteristics of somebody who embodies the hacker work ethic, let's talk about its bigger brother right now, the bigger mean brother, the Protestant work ethic. The Protestant work ethic wasn't always called this. Max Weber, in 1904, 1905 or so, wrote an essay called The Protestant Work Ethic and the Spirit of Capitalism. He was remarking on the 16th century rise to these two different concepts that really kind of harmonically converged and gave a bigger boost to both of them. The notion of work as a duty for the spirit of capitalism, here's a direct quote, labor must be performed as if it were an absolute end of itself, a calling. That makes me want to puke. Also arising in the 16th century, the work ethic taught by the Protestants furthers this idea. The way that it was summarized by these three tenets, work must be seen as an end in and of itself. One must do one's part as well as possible, whatever you're assigned. Work must be regarded as a sacred duty. It must be done because it must be done, need not necessarily have a purpose. The precursor for this was in the monasteries. Benedict, in the 16th century, stated in his monastic rule that idleness is the enemy of the soul. You know, and that he recanted a story about this one monk who was given a task. He recanted a story, evidently, with a tear in his eye fondly he recanted this story about this monk who was given a task of moving a boulder that an entire group of men had spent half a day trying to move. And the man kept trying and kept trying and kept trying. And, you know, obviously never got there. And this was a favorite parable, evidently, of Benedict. It was said that the work was meant to humble the soul of the worker. Monks, they were taught not to question the work. However, I want to say Sisyphean. I think that's right. Sisyphean it was. I don't know how to make an adjective out of Sisyphus. The Protestant Reformation pulled this out of the monasteries and started spreading it around. And it didn't take long for the Protestant work ethic to really just be something not really associated with the church. Just, it's kind of like Platonic love. You don't think of Plato when you think of Platonic love. It's the same way as Protestant work ethic doesn't necessarily have anything to do with Protestants these days. But it is a formidable force in business right now. I want to do my job well. I hate that. It doesn't say I want to be good at my job. It doesn't say I want to be good at something like I want to be a damn good C-coder. I want to do my job well for the company, for the whatever, for the... This has been beat into us pretty much for our entire lives. And it's helped to elevate the status of the highest importance of the work job, or to be what you're doing, is what you're doing good for the company? Is it, you know, who saw Office Space? Is what I'm doing good for the company? This leads to workaholics, leads to guilt. If you miss work, I had great guilt about missing my job. I mean, even it was very, you know, very Protestant work ethic based, but I really had a lot of guilt because, mainly because of the people. I appreciated my boss. He was a really good guy to me. So I had a lot of, you know, guilt calling in sick or missing something. I had a lot of guilt when I left. I left right when they were in the middle of a big push to get a release out the door, mainly because of bad timing and the release that got pushed back. And I had a lot of guilt for that. So anyway, let's go on. But hey, we're in the information society, right? Why haven't the technological advances that are supposed to compress time, to give us more flexible time, freed us to make our lives less work-centered? Why haven't companies taken up on that? Has this happened? No, not yet. Work is still the nucleus of life. Now it's the means to the end. Ever since the Protestant work ethic came out, Weber actually, I had a quote in there, and I can't believe he actually said it, but I guess I can understand it. It's been beat into us so many times, that the highest good, and this just made me sick that he said the highest good that you can do is try to make more money. Money was the center of his argument. It was the result of all of these, of his arguments. Money was, in his eye, the highest goal. This hacker ethic that Pekka has labeled but has been around for quite a while, it challenges this dominant ethic by redefining really kind of the purpose of life for somebody working. Friday versus Sunday. What I mean by this is Sunday, pre-Protestant work, in the Middle Ages and whatnot, Sunday was deemed to be what you were working for. You worked all day, you worked all your whole life. Heaven was viewed as a Sunday. It was an eternal Sunday that never ended. I'll talk about this a little bit later, but the sense of time, the sense of urgency in the Middle Ages wasn't there as well. Friday was viewed, and Augustine, actually in the 5th century, another monk put in his monastic rule, he likened life to a Friday, the toil before the great Sunday of heaven. Adam and Eve sinned, and by the way, I'm an atheist, so, you know, I'm not paying attention to any of this. Adam and Eve sinned on a Friday. Christ died on a Friday. Therefore, life is working on a Friday, and you're working for the weekend, which is Sunday. The pre-Protestants, they saw hell as an eternal Friday. You were beaten by instruments from work. You were hit by hammers and chopped into pieces by sickles. Sisyphus was doomed in Tartarus. Is that right? Tartarus. To push a rock up a hill forever and watch it come down and go push it up again. In Dante, he saw the Dante's Divine Comedy. The character saw the money, the really cheapskates, and the spendthrift. Is spendthrift the right word? Okay, the opposite. Both of them pushing big stones around in a circle, yelling at each other, you know, save, spend, save, spend. It was, and that's the way they viewed hell. The Protestant Reformation moved this center of life from Sunday, what you were, you know, the thing which you exemplified to Friday, you exemplified the work day during life. This actually was illustrated by Daniel Defoe, a man who's trained as a Protestant preacher in the writing of Robinson Crusoe. Man gets on an island, has nothing to do, works all day, doesn't take it easy. He rescues an Aborigine, he names him Friday, oddly enough, and describes him as a tireless and loyal worker. No matter what he's doing, he's a tireless and loyal worker. Hackers really are a lot closer to this Sunday than Friday, and a lot closer to pre-Protestant thought than the Protestant work ethic. And frankly, I think that they split the difference pretty well. I mean, you right on a Saturday, you know, you're not preoccupied necessarily with making a living on Saturday. You work on things which are interesting to you, directly relate to you, have personal tangibility, and hey, you know, take a nap when you need to. Getting into the hacker work ethic now, as contrast to this Protestant work ethic, the main motivations for incorporating this into your life: spiritual challenge in your work, and peer recognition. We'll talk about these in turn. Spiritual challenge. This is not a new idea. People in academics have been doing it for millennia. It is a passionate relationship with your work. Two cases here. Richard Feynman. Everybody know who Richard Feynman is? Yeah? Okay. Not that many people. He's a physicist. He worked on the Manhattan Project. He was the kind of person, he was what I would call a physics hacker. He was the kind of person who, when given something to think about, when given a new result from an experiment or something, he went and he worked through these problems. He was a theorist. He worked through the problems on paper before he tried to, at least before he ever picked up a book. He tried to come about at the problem from any way he could. And this is, he actually learned, I can't remember if it was, I think it was basic integral calculus this way. He came about it from a different, completely different way from the way it's taught. By doing this, he were able to get a lot better grasp of the field, of the problem. And he grokked the problem. Anybody know what that word means, grok, from Stranger in Strange Land? He completely understood the problem. And thus, and it also made him a very good teacher. And if you see his books, he's got a number of books like Lectures on Physics, which is very easy to understand generally by even people not in the field. He's also got a book called Lectures on Computation. Jesse James, anybody know who I'm talking about with Jesse James? He makes choppers. He makes motorcycles. I saw a special on this guy, and I said, you know, if I were to ever make motorcycles, I want to be this guy. He is a metal. He determined to make these motorcycles. He makes them from scratch. He actually, I'm not sure if he broke in or was given permission. He went into old metal forming factories to get the tools to do this with. He takes his gas tank, start out as a big piece of metal, and he pounds them into shape, and then works them on the metal forming tools. These things are works of art. They're gorgeous. And he is there, you know, all day, every day. He is passionate about his creation of these bikes. This is somebody who got lucky. He found that he was good at something. He was making a decent living at it, because not many people can make these bikes. The result of this, not to be bored, to work on interesting things. I think that's kind of obvious. ESR. Eric S. Raymond, for those of you who don't know, he's open source advocate. He uses the term passion to describe this, like I've said a couple of times by now. Passion to an activity is intrinsically interesting and inspiring and joyful. And it's not just to computers, but it goes to everything. It corresponds to the entertainment leg of Linus's law with respect to computers. Activity in a field motivated by the desire to create something. The second motivation of a hacker typically, money is in there, I'm sure, but peer recognition is a big one. Peer recognition, calling yourself a hacker is okay. Being called one, I'm sure many people in this room would understand, is a hell of a lot better. Being called a hacker from a group of your peers, from a group of hackers, not from the FBI, is something. It's something worth it. It's old hat to call somebody elite these days, but similar thing. These people I call the single namers. Linus, who is in charge of the Linux kernel. Alan is one of his generals, one of his lieutenants. Alan Cox. He actually has his own kernel branch. RMS Richard M. Stallman, who started the GNU effort, the free software effort. And ESR is a big open source guy. He controls a number of open source programs these days. These are people that are known by their names or initials in this case, and you got to think that they like it. I mean, that's something that I'm sure that they live for. But it's not all they live for. The passion of their work drives them as well. Perhaps misguided, anybody on Kazaa, download a movie, see Dominion in the file name. A lot of these people, they're working under the same feeling of recognition. They're seeing these, they want to put out these files with branded with their names. Go ahead, dude. You know, you may be targeted, but that's one other aspect of this. Is a peer recognition aspect of motivation. Motivation in the workspace. Performance reviews. He's a good, loyal worker. I hate to see that. I would rather see he's very good at his job, or he's a creative thinker and a good problem solver. I've been called a loyal worker before. It wasn't great. I'd rather be called good at my job. There is a subtle difference there, the focus being on the worker and not the company. Okay, the characteristics. Laziness. Accountability and also in the way that they view time. Laziness, let me qualify. Hackers can be lazy, definitely, but in a good way. It's not being spoon-fed entertainment. It's wanting to automate out the repetition in your work. It's being bored at your job, so you want to make it better. You want to do something to make your job a little bit different, interesting, and better. ESR has a quote, being a hacker is lots of fun, but it's the kind of fun that takes a lot of effort. Eileen Frisch, does anybody know this person? I believe she's a computational chemist. She wrote a book for O'Reilly called System Administration. And this is one thing from that book that stuck in my brain. I read all the way through it. She wrote that laziness is a virtue in a sysadmin. That when you minimize the time of doing repetitive menial tasks, that you spend more time working often on the tool to do that, but it's a lot more fun. It's a lot more interesting. What happens when you spend more time on the tool to fix the problem than you do fixing the problem? Well, hey, you're releasing it into the wild. You open source it, put it out there for other people, because you probably solved a problem that other people have come up against. Another ESO quote for you, to behave like a hacker, you have to believe this, and we're talking about that the people don't have to go through stupid repetitive work, enough to want to automate away the boring bits as much as possible, not just for yourself, but for everybody else. And I've often found that making the tools a hell of a lot more fun than actually doing the work, so it's another reason to go. Accountability, the second characteristic that I noted here. I'm sure there are plenty of others, and after I finish spewing all of what I have to say, we'll turn up the lights and hopefully have a decent discussion here. In Protestant work ethic, you have a worker, you have managers, and more managers above them and whatnot. You need help with a problem. Often you have to go to a manager to get somebody else assigned in, or to be able to go to another group. You have to talk to various managers. You know, in a hacker work ethic, you are responsible for yourself. Hacker helps hacker. I put XP in here. Anybody know what extreme programming is? You've heard of this, you know? There are a couple of interesting things in there. Taken as a whole, it seems freakishly loony, but little parts of it are kind of interesting. One of them is that you if asked to help somebody else, somebody asks you for help, you do. You have to help them. That's one of the rules. And I don't appreciate that, but you know, I like the concept of all the programmers, all the people working on a task to be on a similar level, so that you can go and ask somebody for help. You don't have to go through red tape channels to do it. Perfect case, the Linux kernel. How many people overseeing the Linux kernel are there? Not very many. How many people working on it are there? Huge numbers. Well, relatively huge numbers. Third characteristic, time. Time sense of how a hacker views his time. Mostly, a lot of the work we're doing, and especially in the information age and computer age, it's actually very creative. You're problem solving. In problem solving, you're often using creative faculties of your brain. Creative processes generally are in the right half of your brain. The right half of your brain doesn't know anything about time. So you know, as I have often will find myself at 3 a.m. wondering why I'm starving, thinking, wow, I got a lot done, but what happened to the light? This is an innately creative process. Often, especially when you're talking about computer hacking, getting into systems, you're using a lot of your creative faculties. It's very much like painting, drawing, whatnot. Though there's also another factor here. In that it is a creative process, a lot of times you don't necessarily feel that now is the right time to do something. Now, you know, that there's, when you talk about work ethic, you think, well, he has a gumption to get up and go in there and work no matter what. Well, you know, maybe sometimes it isn't the right time to work on one thing, but maybe another part of the project. The good thing, in a hacker work ethic, that's maybe left to you other than a manager. In a Protestant work ethic, time is money. There's no time for play in work, necessarily. No pinball machines in the break room, necessarily, or maybe that's the only concession. This concept of rigid form of time during the day based around work was brought up again from the monasteries. There were 7 canonical office hours: dawn, 9 a.m., noon, 3 p.m., 6 p.m., dusk, and night. Kind of a little fuzzy there, but nonetheless, your life was rigidly defined by these times of the day. Reformation spread this kind of time sense, this ordering of the day based around work, to the rest of the world. Now more and more, there's no time for play and play. Not only is there no time also for play and work, no time for play and play. Even life outside of work is being optimized on an hour-for-hour, minute-for-minute basis. In the way of work, we're breaking things down every 15 minutes, you know, that 6:15 to 6:30, drive little Timmy to soccer practice, 6:30 to 7, go to the gym and walk 10 minutes. I think that's fairly sick. The worst thing, I think, is taking a class to learn how to relax. you have to hyper optimize your time outside of work, evidently. And even people will practice for their work skills outside of work. Status symbols of the 90s, of the 2000s. You think you're busy. I had to take the kids into doctor's appointment. I didn't have any time for myself. I need to go to my yoga class. And one other point of optimization in the home, childcare. That term quality time, I hate it. It's making the time that you spend with the people that you're, not necessarily child, but spouse, making the time you spend with them evidently more important by doing something like going to theme park or going to a class together or whatnot. Here's a little Weber quote I throw in there. Irregular work, which the laborer is often forced to accept, is often unavoidable, but always an unwelcome state of transition. A man without a calling thus lacks systematic, methodical character, which is demanded by worldly asceticism. If you do piecemeal work, you're a bum, right? Is that what he's saying? Like I said before, even though the technology has supposedly allowed us to compress this time, to make it more flexible, we can't seem to get out of this. And it's only recently, when we're talking about the hacker work ethic and the people trying to incorporate this into their lives, are people starting to break out of that mold a little bit. For everybody else, it's actually kind of having a reverse effect. We're turning our playtime around for work, or instead of being able to have time for the kids in the week, we are working more on the weekend. Hacker version of flex time, it's organized a lot less rigidly, not necessarily where work is the center of the map. I know it's not the center of my map. Well, sometimes it is. Sometimes it isn't. Sometimes I'm interested in going into work, or I'm interested in a problem at work. I'll stay there until it's done. And sometimes just nothing is working. Just nothing. And say screw it, go do something else for a couple of hours, because it doesn't help when your mind is frustrated. Plato has some words about this, about being able to take charge of your own time. And I swear I did not make these up. Scholon, I guess that's how you say it. Having charge of one's time. I'm not sure if this is Latin or if this is something else. Does anybody know? I think it's Latin, because the next one is ascholi, not having charge of one's time, also known as, in his time, slavery. When you did not have control of your own time, evidently, it was akin to slavery. In pre-Protestant life, people were in charge of their time a lot more. The people that the serfs to the landowners, they definitely had work to do, but as I understand it, the time was kept track of in a looser sense. When the crop comes in, and when the sun goes down, middle of the day. Not 3:15. That I already said. This I already said, too. The hacker rhythm follows it's a rhythm of creativity. Instead of sitting in front of a computer doing nothing because you don't understand what is going on and you can't go to somebody because you have to go through red tape to go to them, it's a rhythm of creativity where you're doing something. You're using your right brain. What happens if you have to justify yourself in this position? You're a worker that's been kind of working projects back and forth. You look at in an academic world, you typically look at a person's work over a long amount of time. over a year, over half a year, instead of per hour, per day. This work time supervision that managers, that bosses have over us, it implies that that we're not necessarily responsible for our own lives, for our own work, that we need continuous guidance. Hackers respect the individual. They're pretty much anti-authoritarian, and a hacker is responsible from himself and from other people looking at him for his own actions. Okay. So the end of it here. So is all this crap all theoretical? Is it impractical? No, it's not impractical. A lot of people are building these into their personal ethics into their work lives and into their personal lives. You will find probably a lot more in upper management in smaller companies because they have a lot less inertia and you can move them faster. Especially startups where this feeling, this work ethic, is at the base, at the very heart of what a startup is. I have a little note here to myself, Compute. Anybody remember Compute magazine? You remember that? It was originally bought out by my mom and a couple of people started that magazine in Greensboro, North Carolina. And I remember it because she was never home. I didn't mind. It was okay. It wasn't like I was pining for her or anything. But she, I saw in her that passion. Probably this is where I get the feeling from. She's kind of gone from project to project like this. She has never had really held a sit down, put your ass in a seat for 8 hours a day job. And right now, and as opposed to my father who has, right now she's having to do that for my father as a receptionist. And she hates it, as I would. The larger companies, I just am on educational leave from 50,000 person company. It's a lot harder to incorporate this in the way you work. But if you express enthusiasm about what you're doing. It's on a person by person basis, but my job, my boss at the time was very good about this. He was very open to hearing what I wanted to do, always what I wanted to do was further the project, but it was not necessarily on things that were on the table at the time, or not in the same way as they were used to thinking about them. So, I'd like to think that if I started a business, I would be doing it for the love of the field or to do the best job I could and not necessarily for the money. That's maybe not realistic. I don't know. We may be approaching a crux there, but probably not anytime soon if Microsoft still keeps going. Before I said that this book was broken up into three sections that Pekka wrote on the hacker network ethic and the money ethic and the work ethic. Frankly, I don't think this middle section of the money ethic is all that different than the other two. I would suggest reading through it, but getting out of it pretty much what the work ethic and the network ethic have to say. And just finish up here with the network ethic of this part of this book. I'm not going to go into this because basically, every other panel in this room has been talking about the various forms of network ethic, the intellectual property, copyright laws, routing around censorship and whatnot. But I will point you out to the two books, or the one book here, Pekka Heimonen, The Hacker Ethic. He also has a little website, thehackerethic.com. Or hackerethic.com, sorry. And second series of books by Manuel Castles, who wrote the epilogue to this book. The Information Age, Economy, Society, and Culture. Tomes, very big tomes, and unfortunately pretty expensive, but very good philosophy of the New Information Society background. This is what the Hacker Ethic book looks like if you see it in a bookstore. And at this point, since this is basically a kind of a talk about philosophy, and I'm not really a philosopher, I'd like to turn up the lights and see if anybody has any comments on any of this, and take it from there. Guys? Hello, workers. Hello.
Yeah. Visualizing a spinning hourglass.
Yeah, he was focused. He was focused out.
I was just going to make an observation about sort of the time frames of the way that the day is actually set up, those different stages of the day. And I recently have left corporate America, you know, with kind of a bitter taste in my mouth, and I'm doing some things that are on my own right now, and I've restructured my day almost completely when I realized, first of all, that being awake during like daylight hours reminds me that I'm not working in corporate America anymore because of all the stuff on TV or whatever, and for whatever reason I'm just getting more work done in the evening. So I sleep during the day, and I do all my work at night, and maybe work for like 5 hours, and, you know, go run a couple of errands or something, and come back and do some more work. It does change things very drastically. I mean, just a comment to open it up.
Personally, I find that I get a lot of work done in the generally in the morning through early afternoon, and then very awake after about 8:30 or 9 through to 1 or 2 in the morning. It's just, I don't know. I don't know if it's a different body cycle or whatnot, but that's when I tend to be more alert and more focused on what I'm doing. I knew you would have something to say, James.
All I was going to say is, you know, you've adopted the hacker work ethic when you've done one of two things. You've either taken a conference call in the nude or in your pajamas. And secondly, if you've ever used a wireless-equipped laptop while on the potty.
I've done that.
Exactly.
Essentially, from what I understand, you prefer the hacker work ethic to the Protestant work ethic. Is that correct?
I typically do, yeah.
Okay. My question is, how, if at all possible, would we apply the hacker work ethic to the rest of the world as opposed to just the computer and business industries and move it into a position where even, say, a janitor at, you know, a high school or whatever would be able to use that so that, you know, they get some amount of enjoyment from their job?
I wouldn't have a full answer to that, but one way I would think to make inroads in that is to give more people responsibility for their own work, for their own actions. I have a good friend. He works in a plant that it was a job he originally got as a temporary position through a temp agency. He works in a plant basically on a floor packaging up DVDs and VCRs and VHS tapes for movies. In fact, I can ask him, you know, what's coming out next pretty soon, and he's seen the things. His job is so regimented, so completely regimented for our basis of time. A lot of it because of, I'm sure because of insurance purposes, that he is not allowed to go do certain things, and I'm not sure if he's even able to suggest different processes to do things, to different ways to move pallets of movies from this place or whatever. I can see that. Basically, he uses it, to make the money to live. He lives pretty cheaply. And B, I imagine, well, I don't know, it's a nighttime job, so he may be completely asleep while he's doing it. But I imagine he lets his brain go, because he's a very artistic person also. He lets his brain go to maybe work on other things subconsciously while he's doing his job. He's mentioned to me a couple of times how, you know, if I could just get him to do this, you know, things would work out a lot better and be a lot more fun. But yeah. I would think giving people more responsibility for their own actions, making them responsible for their position and for the improvement of their position, would be a very good place to start at all levels. Now, just bringing this attitude, this attitude of well, you know, boss, I work a lot better at different times of the day. Maybe we can work a compromise, do a little, you know, actual flex time, not just 7 to 3. Do, you know, do you know, you have your face time for the management, and then you have your more concentrated work time, maybe. Yeah, and there's plenty of places where it necessarily shouldn't apply. It's not a panacea. We're talking about something that has gone. You know, the best thing that I've seen come out of a purely hacker work ethic process has been the Linux kernel, and even that, in the past couple of years, a lot of the driving force has been from corporate interest. So, you know, we see the base of this kernel come out from a wonderful collection of hackers working together to create something really cool. And a purely hacker work ethic thing, you took on part of the project that you were interested in. You grabbed a piece of the project that you found interesting, and you started working on it, and they incorporated it in. You found a bug, you sent in a patch, they incorporated it in. Linus and Alan and I guess a couple other people were in charge of how many hundreds of people, thousands of people working on the kernel? I mean, that's a pretty good manager to worker ratio, isn't it? And they did pretty good. In 9 years, they're in enterprise servers and basically are supplanting 30-year-old companies, or 30-year-old computer technology companies in pretty short amount of time. So, discuss, yeah.
Yeah, I think one important point there is the organization from being set tasks to accomplish,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to working hours.
Right.
You know, doing a job right. Instead of being here 8 hours a day.
No, I'm not going to say that was a panacea.
Right.
Well, but I mean, that's plenty of people need structure like
sure.
that, and they want it, and that's fine. But really, I think that would be better to be a personal choice.
Right, right.
Yeah, boss, I need you to tell me what you want me to do, either on a hour-by-hour basis or on a project-by-project basis. Or
well, I mean, not necessarily just the organization on an hour-by-hour basis, but I mean the fact that you're not even paid by what you do. You're paid by how many hours you were here.
Right.
And that's really endemic to the
state. Yeah, and in fact, hourly work for salaried employees, you know, a couple years ago, I wouldn't knock it because I was getting paid a decent amount of money to basically be glorified tech support for a supercomputer. So it was like, about 2-3 hours of work a day, maybe, and
right.
you know, at the time. But you know, I take that back. I did knock it, and I do knock it because it was fucking boring. Okay, I would have loved to be there working on something that had meaning, and a lot of the work that was going on there did have meaning. It was physics, it was chemistry, it was biology, it was mechanical engineering, things that were very interesting, that were the forefront of research. And that part I loved. The other part that I sat around and changed out passwords for people. You know, you want to know how many scripts I wrote to try to do things like that, to try to automate out that stupid shit that kept coming up every day after day. It was the money that kept me there at the time, and I'm kind of actually glad it's gone right now. And right now I'm getting a pittance as a fellowship to go to school to finish a degree. So, actually it's working out a lot better. You know, I'm getting about a third of what I made before, but you know, I'm finishing my PhD and enjoying life a hell of a lot more. So,
just observation, I guess, seems to me that the conflict between the hacker ethic and the corporate ethic, one way the hacker ethic could be marketed is that here you got people who are enthusiastic about it, they're willing to do the job for less.
Maybe.
If it's a job, it can
be. I tell you something, I'm not going to do a job. I'm not going to do a job for less where a corporation gets the benefit of my job, of my work.
I'm saying it's a way to sell it, not the way it actually will work.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying. And a couple of the things I don't appreciate. I think there was a two-pronged attack when Apple went with Darwin and went with open sourcing Darwin. I'm sure part of it was getting free bug checking and free tech support. I'm sure that's how it got through the boardroom and it got through the main. They looked and they said, hey, look at all these people working on Linux kernel. Wow, you know, and we could get these people checking bugs for us. And so I'm sure that it was marketable in front to the geek factor for being an open source OS, but also it was marketable to the boardroom for being an open source OS for different reasons.
I think it has a lot to do with the culture of the organization which is being used in. For example, I think it was one of the Swedish car companies, either Saab or Volvo, repurposed their teams. Rather than you put on a wheel every time a car comes by, you reassemble the teams to reassemble a car so that you take pride in what you manufacture rather than the task.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So, and
that's something big. That falls into peer recognition, that you're able to look at something and say, that falls into both. You're able to look at something and say, wow, I made this, and you're able to look at your friend and say, hey, look, I made this. You get a little peer recognition from it. You get self satisfaction from it. I agree with that. I fully agree with that. Henry Ford was an asshole. By creating the assembly line, he did a great thing for business, but not for the person. Anybody else have any comments? Talk amongst yourselves, please. Was this complete and utter bullshit, or did it strike a chord? It struck a chord with me when I read the book. I don't mean to be a pecka whore. But it really did strike a chord, and I appreciated it, and I kept wanting to do it, but whenever I said Pekka Hyman, and I wanted to do this, but I thought that would be a little rude. So. It did strike a chord with me, and it struck me as a little bit more true than things I'd heard. It also struck me as an amalgamation of various ideals coming together that I'd heard in numerous different places. Anybody else?
Anyone?
Bueller? Bueller? Bueller?
Okay.
Up here? What time is it?
15 minutes, I think.
Oh, shit. I thought it'd last about 20 minutes. Okay.
I think we might have seen a little bit of the hacker work ethic when the .com explosion sort of hit.
Absolutely.
Because the money was there. And
yeah.
So, you know, the higher ups were willing to allow a little more of that flexibility,
mm-hmm.
and you know they were a little more they weren't so rigid with the way we had to work. But then once everything crumbled, I think they went back to that old business mentality,
mm-hmm.
and you got back to thinking of the you know, that religious aspect of it being very structured. And I guess my question is, you think the ultimate success of these tech companies, they're going to have to incorporate some hacker ethic into the overall organizational structure?
I think the ones that do...
Right, for ultimate success.
Yeah. I think the ones that do tend to be able to change paces quickly and more quickly. When you rely on the creativity of your people and not just try to make drones of them, a lot more interesting things come about. Brilliance is born in the mind of a single mind, and carried to fruition maybe by a group, but a brilliant idea never comes out of a committee.
Oh,
I hate that concept. Committee.
Disagree.
You do?
Yes.
Who?
I work.
What?
Me. The guy who's running.
No. But what's your?
I'm sorry. I've worked on a number of committees, especially marketing committees, where we have had to come.
Well, there's
up
your problem
ideas.
Right there.
Well.
Just kidding. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. All right. Rampant bigotry amongst the computer geeks. Okay, sorry. We've worked on a number of, I and my team have worked on several marketing ideas where we have to come up with a creative solution to how to market some mm-hmm. person's XYZ idea effectively and how to sell it to either the investors of the corporation
mm-hmm.
or how to sell it to somebody else in management or...
Yeah.
Since it's a group of people, it's
maybe,
a committee.
Maybe, yeah. I see what you're saying. I understand. To me, every committee I've ever seen comes up with an average process. It comes up with the average of everybody in the committee, at least all the vocal people. Now, maybe most of them aren't vocal, and so you end up with what is basically in the mind of one or two of the people. But to me, what comes out of it is an average. I always had a saying that the... Right, yeah. If you can hold a filibuster in a committee, then you win. I've always had a saying that the IQ of a committee is inversely proportional to its population.
That's something that's commonly quoted in all of my management classes.
So I came up with that. Maybe somebody else came up with it.
Just say the company can work by a hacker ethics, so can a committee.
Sure.
So that
sure.
Maybe his committees are hacker ethic committees.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I imagine a lot of the directions that the kernel took, that the Linux kernel took, were directions that were pointed out to the people that are the small group of people in charge of the direction of the where it should go, the technologies. I guess it depends on how it's connected, how the committee is connected together. If it is a group of peers, great. If it is a group of I don't know. I'm spouting on. Go ahead.
Hello.
Okay.
Where I've worked before, the work ethic is based on trust levels. Almost either my mind is kind of a PGP kind of
uh-huh.
who do you trust, who you. At a higher level, the corporate, if they trust the manager,
mm-hmm.
it can be kind of like a boat at sea. And at that level, I've always worked for small. 5 or 6 employees in a place, and
mm-hmm.
as long as the numbers come back to a certain place, anything can happen.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Very hacker ethic between there, but when we get on a conference call, it's not so much anymore. It's very strict. And
yeah. And I can see that. I can understand that. That's what people are taught in business school. That's how you run a company. And I'm not, you know, I'm here. I'm not making as much as they do. I'm not living as high and on the hog as they do. So I don't know if I can say that I'm as successful as they are. You know, I don't know. Are they as happy as I am in what I'm doing? In what, you know, in their job? If so, then great, you know, they win, maybe. I would suggest that something like that is a good way to influence business on a larger scale, on the larger scale businesses, to have these local enclaves of a hacker ethic mentality that are connected together in other enclaves, maybe. Or maybe maybe that is the where you have to draw the line between a classical business school business and a hacker ethic mentality, because I honestly think you get a lot better work out of people if they have a lot more responsibility for their work and are, you know, obviously are enthused about their work. But getting them all to work on something, you know, trying to get hackers to work on something together is like herding cats. So maybe you do have to fall back to classical business practices.
The better use of
taser. Well,
some of them have tasers to whatever.
Yeah. Okay. Got to wrap it up, guys. I hope you enjoyed this and the rest of the con. And please stay around for Hacking 201, which is tonight. And if I'm not mistaken, and I'm going to be needing some, there is beer for good questions. So have fun. Bye.